A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging arts organizations. We'll look at the impact of the economy, technology, and society on the arts, the importance of arts education, and how these organizations and ensembles are adjusting and innovating as they face the future. Today, we'll head on down to Atlanta to delve into the archives of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. The symphony earlier this summer announced plans to transfer its archival materials to Georgia State University, and we'll hear about what's in the collection and how they reflect the orchestra's history. My guests will be orchestra archivist Bob Scar and Kevin Fleming, archivist for GSU's Popular Music and Culture Collection. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Houston's Wortham Center, home to the Houston Grand Opera, Houston Ballet, and several other city arts organizations, will remain closed through at least May as it recovers from damage sustained during Hurricane Harvey. According to the Houston Chronicle, the Houston Grand Opera is searching for a venue for its season opener performance of La Traviata October 20th and its other performances, and Houston Ballet has relocated its first production to the Hobby Center. The Chronicle also reported that Wortham owner Houston First has said the center's parking garage was inundated by more than 200 million gallons of water. Although its two theaters avoided structural damage, Houston First is awaiting results of studies of damage to the mechanical and electrical equipment. Members of Houston's theater district, which also includes the Houston Symphony and Alley Theater, are holding a benefit performance September 27th to raise funds for victims of the hurricane's flooding. The Philadelphia Orchestra kicks off a week-long We're Here campaign this Monday to showcase its family and community-oriented programs of its HEAR, H-E-A-R, initiative. Events include small ensemble performances and master classes, including one by Hilary Hahn, at schools across the city, music therapy sessions, and a sensory-friendly concert at Verizon Hall, designed to be accessible for families and individuals with cognitive or learning differences. The orchestra launched its HEAR project, which stands for Health, Education, Access, and Research, in April 2016. Details are available at philorc.org/HEAR. Washington National Opera has named Timothy O'Leary as its new general director beginning next July. O'Leary is currently general director at Opera Theater of St. Louis, a position he has held since 2008, and is also chair of the board at Opera America. In its statement, Washington National Opera cited O'Leary's success in working with local communities and his leadership within the opera world at large. O'Leary's tenure in St. Louis has been credited with doubling the opera company's endowment, commissioning and staging new works, and quadrupling subscription sales to Gen X and millennial audiences. He will succeed Michael Male at Washington National Opera, who had served as executive director for 9 years until stepping down this past June. The Cincinnati Inquirer has become the latest major metropolitan newspaper without an arts critic. Music America reported that Janelle Gelfand was among 5 reporters let go by the newspaper last Tuesday. Gelfand had covered the Cincinnati Orchestra closely, including the tenure of music director Louis Langres and the ongoing renovations of the orchestra's performance venue, Music Hall, which is slated to reopen in October. According to a report by Cincinnati public radio station WVXU, the paper had moved several other arts-related reporters to news and feature beats in the past year, after a broader shakeup of arts and entertainment staff in 2014. Devoted arts coverage has been a frequent target of newsroom reductions across the country as media companies seek to reduce costs and adapt to a changing consumer. Sales of vinyl recordings accounted for almost a third of all physical recording shipments in the U.S. in the first half of 2017. The highest percentage in about 3 decades. According to industry results released by the Recording Industry Association of America, vinyl made up 29% of the retail value of physical shipments, with revenue rising 3% in the first 6 months of the year compared with the previous year period. Physical recordings, which also include CDs, are still vastly overshadowed in today's internet-focused distribution system, accounting for just 16% of overall music industry revenue in the first half of this year, compared with 19% for digital downloads and 62% for streaming services, including subscription services such as Amazon Prime and Pandora Plus. Overall, U.S. industry sales still remain below 1999 levels. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. If you're a history buff like me, there's nothing quite like entering the halls of memory created by mementos from the past. Photos of events, momentous or everyday, concert programs detailing repertoire and soloists, or newspaper clippings documenting a special trip or program. So it was a bit of a treat a few years ago when, during a trip to Atlanta, I reached out to the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra to see if I could stop by. It was summertime, but its archivist, Bob Scar, was available, and we spent about an hour chatting about the collection of programs, posters, recordings, and business documents, and walking through the boxes that contained the history of the orchestra that was then preparing to mark its 70th anniversary. Among some of the highlights he pointed to were the orchestra's creation originally as a youth orchestra, the tenure of music director Robert Shaw, and the role the orchestra played against the backdrop of a changing world, from a European tour in the 1980s that took the orchestra to East Berlin, to events that acknowledged the social and cultural changes taking place in Atlanta and the South during the 60s and 70s. I thought of that trip recently when the orchestra announced that it would be turning those very boxes over to the archives at Georgia State University for future safekeeping. I reached out to Bob and to Kevin Fleming, archivist for GSU's Popular Music and Culture Collection, to talk about why this was a good fit, future plans for the archive, and what we can learn by studying the orchestra's historical record. What is, in general, what is seen as the benefit of having the archives move over to GSU?
From my personal point of view, and Rachel, I think you and I talked about this 3 years ago or so, after writing a grant and getting some consideration for grant money, the final analysis was, you know, we had certain holes in the archives. In other words, not a lot of apparent institutional support for the archives, which I understand that. But the suggestion was that either the Woodruff Arts Center hire a full-time archivist for all of its divisions or look for a repository in the Atlanta area. And I had a great archive advisory board, and they all pretty much agreed there's only really two places that you should consider, and one was the University of Georgia, and one was Georgia State University. And so it gave a lot of us here at the orchestra a little bit of peace of mind, knowing that they're going to be in a safe environment and properly preserved, described, and made available to the public.
Kevin?
Yeah, one thing was, I mean, we're an established archive here. The Special Collections and Archives started in 1971, and we have various collecting areas. And so we're, you know, have the facilities to store materials, like, you know, proper climate control and security for collections. And we have, you know, a research room for students and patrons to come in and look at the materials. And so in terms of preservation and access, that was a good reason to move it here. And then also, one of the deciding factors that I felt that was important to bring it here was early on I got together with the directors at the School of Music at Georgia State, and they were very intrigued about having the collection here in terms of that the faculty and students could get great use out of it. So that was a good deciding factor of, you know, how much is this collection actually going to be used.
What are some of the ways and who are some of the people that you feel the archives could be used by and for?
Well, I mean, the collection will be open to everyone. Outside researchers, the GSU community, meaning the faculty and students, and then, you know, patrons, just anybody who's interested in it. And actually, I got a call yesterday from a gentleman who used to teach here at Georgia State, and he was on in the orchestra as well, and next month he's going to come down and look at some of the materials that we've already have transferred over here. But, you know, it could be used in class projects, either undergraduates writing, you know, short papers or up to the extent of, you know, dissertations by graduate students. You know, faculty have to do scholarship, so they could do articles, books, anything like that. And then just the general public as well. With some of my other music collections, I get, you know, quite a bit of outside researchers, but then all people that are just, you know, fans of music, and they want to come in and look at some of the original materials.
Bob, do you have any thoughts, or are there people who were using them while they were under the orchestra's purview?
Oh, absolutely, and that really made my day when the marketing folks here at the orchestra or the PR folks wanted background material on certain things, certain events that happened with the orchestra over the years. I mean, like, for example, a few years ago, we started doing concerts again in Piedmont Park, and they would come to me saying, "Bob, can you show us some of the articles and photographs from the 70s and 80s when we were out there?" So, there would be something every, maybe not every day, but at least once a week where people needed to see this or that, or can you verify this particular date, and did we play this on this day, and, you know, things like that. So, and that's what archives is all about. It's not a revenue generator, but it is, but it does support all the divisions of the orchestra.
Well, let's talk a bit about what is in this archive collection. What range of documents and material does it include?
Yeah, one of the priorities for going forward is making the actual concert programs available and online, and so we're talking about concert programs dating back to 1945, and we have a complete collection of those all the way up to June of this year, and so that's one really specific area that we are looking at and looking forward to having them scanned and in a format that is searchable online.
That'll be one of the, because we're getting the collection in stages, and that's one of the first things we got in, and that'll be one of the first projects, because we have a digitization unit here in the library that we do quite a bit of publications that we've digitized and put online, and so that's going to be the first step. But then also some of the things that Bob had brought me recently is press release materials, scrapbooks, there's going to be audiovisual materials, broadcast recordings. Even before we transferred the materials here, Bob had brought in some Betacam tapes that needed to be digitized and help them out with that.
Right. We've got hundreds, well, actually, probably thousands of photographs documenting the history, thousands and thousands of 35-millimeter slides. And so that's another area that's, you know, it doesn't just document the, and this goes back to the concert programs at will. It doesn't necessarily just document the orchestra, but it documents, you know, the history of Atlanta, and especially when you read the concert programs and look at the ads and look at, you know, what was going on in Atlanta during those times. So that's kind of an important part to bring out as well.
Also in the collection, you know, there's contracts and royalty statements, like the bargaining agreements with the musicians' union, some board minutes, financial records, and things like that. So typical, you know, just the day-to-day operations, the paperwork involved or the documentation involved with that, crucial part of the collection as well.
I know, Bob, when we met a few years ago, you talked about some of the highlights, I guess, in the symphony's history and how some of that was reflected in the archives. What would you say are some real highlights that you can learn about through the archives?
Yeah, that's a great question. Gosh, we have a pretty good collection of Robert Shaw, you know, the famous conductor we had here for from 67 to 88, documenting mm-hmm. his career, his writings, and photographs of him, and that to me is sort of the highlight of the collection. The majority of his personal collection did go into Yale University, which and I know Kevin can probably speak to this a little bit of maybe having a tie-in or an internet connection there, a link to that archives as well. But anyway, going back to answering your question, the 1988 European tour was rather historic during that time, as we were the largest performing arts group to travel to East Berlin during that time, and that 10-day tour is fully documented in the archives, and it's kind of exciting for a lot of people to go back and revisit those years.
And Kevin, from your perspective, are there any particular historical points or aspects that you're looking to really get into or to publicize?
Well, I think the radio broadcast recordings that we're going to get, granted they'll be limited for access just on campus here, just due to copyright restrictions. But making those available to the students and faculty, and then, you know, the general public, if they come into the library to access those, I think would be rather interesting. You know, because it's a large amount that was recorded besides, you know, the commercial released materials. So I think that'll be very interesting. And then also I think the, you know, contracts and negotiations and things like that are always very interesting. I have some of those in some of my other collections, and they seem to be very popular with just trying to find out more of the behind the scenes of how an organization functioned. Mm-hmm. Researchers have mm-hmm. interest in that.
Now, going forward, what type of continued collaboration and partnership and relationship will there be between the orchestra and the archives? Will things be brought over immediately or every few years? Have you figured those details out?
Yeah, well, we're working in the process now of, bringing things over, about once a week. Bob will bring about 20 or so boxes over, and that'll probably increase shortly of bringing more materials over. But yes, carrying on about once a year, we'll touch base and whatever new materials, and obvious one would be programs and other new materials that were created, we'll accession those into the collection as well. And that's how a lot of our collections function that way. We don't want to just have a cutoff date of when, you know, we actually got the first accession of the collection. We want to have it continue to grow. Earlier, about a month or so ago, or 2 months, Bob brought over a couple of the website developer and the social media person from the ASO. And so obviously we'll work together with them with if they're posting something and they need materials for us, basically to help keep promoting the collection throughout, the future, basically. So people are aware that we have it, because we don't want to just do publicity now and then people forget about it, that it's actually here at Georgia State. So we, want to keep it active, I guess is the best term.
Mm-hmm. And now you referred to the digitization project earlier. What are some of the long-term plans for where you'd like to see that going?
Well, we don't digitize everything in collections. It's literally selective. A lot of it is photographs, and then some of the other things in my collections are small publications like newsletters that are, 20 pages long or things like that. And sometimes we gauge it on interest and also if something is fragile, if someone's going to be handling it a lot. For one example, of the scrapbooks, the really old ones, like any typical scrapbook, the paint or the tape or the glue in it, starts to deteriorate, and the pages or the material on the pages start to fall off and things like that. So that's quite common as well, that we'll digitize those and make those available online just for preservation purposes, so they're not being handled all the time. The condition get worse on them. And then, of course, audiovisual materials. They've already done a lot of the digitization for the radio broadcasts, but I know there's other videos and things like that that'll need to be dealt with because, tape deteriorates, and then also players are becoming more rare. But we do have the players in-house here now to where we can do it. So.
And Bob, I'm curious, I wanted to turn to you and just get a sense, how did you become involved in the archives, and what have you enjoyed during your time kind of shepherding them through?
Well, I was invited to come work at the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in February of 2010, and in a development capacity, and it was basically a job to get my foot in the door and to learn a little bit about the makings behind the scenes of staff work in with an orchestra. And it was only going to be a temporary position, but I was determined to be relative and be trying to be involved in some significant way. And there was an early conversation, I guess, in 2011, when our new president said to our general manager, "So what are we doing about our archives?" And I happened to hear the conversation, and
And I decided I would be a little bit proactive and learn everything I could from other archivists who were involved in performing arts groups. And so they assigned me a task of just trying to come to grips with all of our assets. How many? What do we have here or off campus? And so that's how it all started. And I did a short internship with Frank Bavella, who's the archivist with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, and I was able to see firsthand exactly, how it should be built. So the enjoyment I got, it was just helping to preserve the wonderful history of the orchestra, and it was on a more personal note. It was an endeavor on my part to preserve the orchestra that I grew up with and I loved dearly when I was going to school, and so it was kind of, to me, it was joy being able to preserve the history and try to make it available to as many people as I can, and especially the donors who come in all the time wanting to see things. So
you referenced earlier being able to see not just the history of the orchestra, but also of the broader community. I was wondering if either of you could elaborate a little bit more on that. What do these archives, what does the history of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra tell us about the broader community and how it's changed and how it is still changing today?
Well, one of the joys for me is, and I was there, I watched it, I saw it all grow. In the early 70s, it was a very good regional orchestra. But what was really sweet about those early 70s when Robert Shaw came in and was our new music director, he was in Cleveland, but he saw what was going on in the South in the 60s. It was exciting to watch him try to use music as a way of bringing, the community together. And one of the very first things he did, by the way, he also enjoyed the writings of the famous Atlanta Journal-Constitution editor, Ralph McGill, the writings and the social problems that were going on during the 60s. But anyway, one of the first things he did when he came here was he engaged and invited and encouraged, Spelman College, Morehouse. He brought in African American composers and artists, and I think that was more than anything. He was he more than some of the political figures in the Atlanta area. I think he did more for kind of bringing that whole community together.
Interesting. Kevin, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about the GSU archives in general. How does this particular collection complement what you have available already?
Well, it's a little bit outside scope of my main collecting area, with it being popular music. A little bit about that collecting area. We have the papers of Johnny Mercer, who was a songwriter from Savannah and wrote like 1,400 songs. Also have country music collections dealing with early country music in Atlanta. Also have some radio broadcasting collections, WSB Radio, which was the first radio station in the South. We have their collection as well. But the interest on this was more that it was, even though it falls out of the scope of, quote-unquote popular music, it's Atlanta-based music. So that was important. So I have other collections that are, I have rock and roll stuff dealing with the Atlanta bands that are played through the campus radio station and things like that. So as long as it was Atlanta-based music, it was fine to go outside of the main scope of the collection. And so that's, I think it fits in well with that. And also just, again, going back to the Atlanta history, like we have the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's photograph collection, which is about 5 million photos. And again, just documenting the history of Atlanta, and you could do it through various different avenues, obviously through photographs, but then like what Bob was saying, through the overall growth of the ASO over the years.
Well, me personally, I'm just It's kind of bittersweet for me to see the collection go, but it's always been one of the very first things I learned from other archivists is that, Bob, don't look at this as a short-term project where you're going to put things in boxes and then put them in a broom closet. Think 20, 30 years down the road. And I could not be more thrilled that the collection is ending up at Georgia State University under the leadership of Kevin Fleming.
And also with, Bob's not, after everything gets transferred here, is he still going to be involved with the collection? We've talked about that where, because he's obviously a valuable resource in terms of the history of the organization and everything like that. So I do that with many of my donors where, the process doesn't stop after we get the actual physical collection in. We carry it on for many years. And I work with different foundations related to like the Mercer Foundation, and there's also the Georgia Radio Hall of Fame, and those are just examples of keeping in contact with the actual donors and, again, growing the collection over the years. And so there will always be an involvement back and forth between GSU and the ASO in the in the future.
Yeah. Hey, I think it's the beginning of and continuing with a great relationship between two really good, great institutions.
And that's one thing we'll do here as well is look and see what other organization or other archives have done with collections like this and either model it after that or, just get ideas from some of the things they've, been able to make available online and things like that and kind of use that as a model.
That was Kevin Fleming, archivist for Georgia State University's Popular Music and Culture Collection, and Bob Scar, archivist for the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra. The Symphony's website can be found at atlantasymphony.org, and you can find more information on the GSU Archives and Collections at blog.library.gsu.edu. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world each week on Autempo. Remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, now celebrating its 35th anniversary, go to wwfm.org and click on Do 35. Thank you for being a member of the global listening community that is the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to Autempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. You can listen to past programs of Autempo by going to our arts and cultural news page at wwfm.org or searching for Autempo on our program page. Autempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.